only measures megahertz. It's that whole argument that actually Belden started, in terms of performance. They say that this new 350 megahertz cable was slightly better and easier way to sell the consumer on proving their needs while charging 15% more. Let's see. Cat 5 is 100 megahertz.
Okay, Cat 5, 100. Cat 6, 250. Cat 6A, 350. Cat 5E, 550 megahertz rating. And that rating is what? A reasonable number of dB loss per 1,000 feet or something like that? If you happen to know, Eric, go ahead.
Let me get to the right spot here and I can tell you exactly what it is. I think it's on the other page. Hang on a second. It is... I just had it. Where'd it go? I'm getting confused. Okay, capacitance, I think it was something like... Give me a second, I'll find it.
This cable makes a good antenna feeder for my 450 megahertz antenna.
Yeah, I got it. Okay. You want return loss? They give that too.
Not as interested in return loss. When it comes to megahertz of rating, is that for a standard length like 100 feet and a standard loss like 1 dB, and that's where the megahertz is coming from? Go ahead.
Yeah, 23 dB from 1 to 20 megahertz to 23 10 log at 20 from 20 to 100 megahertz. I think this is all 100 feet. About 100 meters, sorry.
Now, 23 dB sounds like a return loss, an S11 scattering parameter that can't be insertion loss. What do you believe is the insertion loss, Eric? Go ahead.
To be honest, I don't know, but you keep talking, I'll find out.
Slowly, we're all becoming smarter. Anyone else have comments on all of the above? Give me your call letters and name right now. KQIW, wait for the beep.
KC2QIQ.
Glenn recognized. Anyone else? You've got it, Glenn.
Yeah, I've never actually measured the insertion loss on the cables, mainly because most of the measurement equipment I have is in 50 ohms, and to actually get a phi balun or something to measure correctly. But I don't think the numbers are quite that high. Your question before about shielding, all the cables, all the ones we just mentioned before, the Cat 5s, the 6s, the 7s, they all come in shielding, and they're marked on the outside. It will say very clearly on the outside of the cable, marked in the writing, it'll say shielded right on the outside. And it's very, very hard to miss because if you look at the connector on the end, the connector actually has like some metallization on the outside of the plastic connector where you can actually see where that's the easiest way to, if you just pick one up and it's got a connector on it, you can actually see the metallization on the Cat 5 connector. Another point of thing here to mention, especially when you're talking about gigabit and very, very long, long distances, from what I'm seeing being done right now is that the variations in cables that they can use on these systems now are incredible. And it's really got to do with how the signal is being transmitted, the transceivers, the quality of the transceivers on both sides and the software being run. Because I'm seeing tremendous data rates moving down cables in just simple Cat 5. And I think that's what everybody's kind of like, working with is the Cat 5. And of course, anything after that is certainly just better performance. K2RIW, KZ2QIQ.
I'm going to throw in a couple of words here with reference to megabits, data rate, megahertz of bandwidth, and so on. A so-called POTS system, plain old telephone system, is good for approximately 5 kilohertz of audio. A naive person would say, okay, I can send audio down there at 5,000 cycles per second. That probably means I can send data down there at 5,000 bits per second. We all know that back in the days when we were using telephone modems, we were getting 56 kilobits. 56,000 bits per second of data was going down that phone line. But the phone has an instantaneous bandwidth of 5 kilohertz. How in the world can that happen? And the answer is reasonably simple, and that is, if the signal-to-noise ratio was high enough, you can transmit, in that particular case, 16 bits or something like that, bits per symbol. In other words, the data doesn't have to go through a complete sine wave of starting off at zero, going to peak voltage, back to zero, negative peak voltage, back to zero, for one complete cycle of data. You can have a whole lot of funny steps to the data. In other words, it can become a tic-tac-toe, so to speak, of where you're looking at a horizontal axis and a vertical axis of individual amplitudes. You don't have to make it a pure sine wave. Depending on which amplitude you jump to represents a particular state of that particular symbol. So if you take a look at the way 16 quad amplitude modulation, 16 QAM, if you Google the word 16 QAM, 16 QAM, and study it enough, you'll discover that you can get a lot of bits of data per symbol transmitted down the line. And it works very well if the signal-to-noise ratio is high enough. For ordinary binary data, I might desire to have at least 12 dB of signal-to-noise ratio to get a reasonable bit error rate. Let me drop. Hey, Dick. Yeah, go ahead.
And then you.
I actually have the loss table here. Actually, your 56K modem is 64 QAM. That's how you're able to get the speed.
Understand. So, and 64, let me think, that's 8 times 8. Does that mean that there is a data compression rate of, I think it's 8 to 1. Is that true? In other words,
don't forget the error correction.
Okay, before I correct and use the cyclic redundancy code or whatever, I think I'm getting 8 bits of data per symbol. Is that approximately right?
Yeah, and there's also two levels of error correction there.
Okay, Alex wanted to make a comment. We'll wait long enough. Go right ahead, Alex.
Well, Dick, if you like QAM, you should take a look at Viterbi. This is some algorithm. Just take a look at it. That is the icing on the cake.
Okay. You said Viterbi. You're going to have to give that to us phonetically. You said it kind of fast, and I didn't recognize it. Back to you, Alex.
Viterbi?
Oh, Viterbi. Okay. It's my accent. Sorry about that.
The Yonkers accent.
Yeah, Viterbi is a man who worked for the Qualcomm company in San Diego. He has a whole lot of patents on this error-correcting code. It's a forward error-correcting code. In other words, you can be sending 256-bit packets of data, and you could have a significant number of error bits within the packet, and the extra bits that are called Viterbi bits will allow you to reconstruct the error-free data up to a point. However, all of these techniques, Viterbi, 64 QAM, and whatever, I think 64 QAM requires something like 32 decibels of signal-to-noise ratio in order to get something like a 10 to the minus 7 bit error rate, whereas I was sending just very dumb, simple binary data, I would have a 10 to the minus 7 bit error rate at something like 12 dB of signal-to-noise ratio. So there's a trade-off here. You have to have high quality of that phone line, but once you do, or whatever your transmission channel is, if it has a high enough integrity in signal-to-noise ratio and correct control of what's called group delay distortion. That's a fancy way of saying that when I'm sending data, when I'm putting square waves, just to be nice and simple, assume I'm sending nice, simple square waves of data. When you look at the spectrum of a square wave, if I put a 1 kilohertz square wave signal from my signal generator into a properly operating spectrum analyzer, let me drop.
I'm confused.
I'll try to unconfuse you. If I'm transmitting nothing but a simple square wave of signal into a spectrum analyzer, and I'm, just for my example, I'm going to make the rate of the square wave 1 kilohertz, because I own a pulse generator, Hewlett-Packard 1802, I think it is, that'll make nice square waves. And find nothing but odd harmonics. I'll find 1 kilohertz harmonics, 3 kilohertz, 5 kilohertz, 7 kilohertz, and they fall off in a very characteristic formula. So, a square wave signal consists of a lot of higher frequency components, and the even harmonics will disappear if the square wave is thoroughly symmetric. If it's not, the even harmonics will be there. But in general, there will always be the odd harmonics at a higher frequency when you're transmitting a nice, sharp square wave. Group delay distortion talks about the fact that the higher frequency harmonics better have the exact same time delay going through that channel, that information channel, as the lower frequency harmonics. Otherwise, things will not line up correctly, and you will not, at the receiving end, be able to reconstruct that nice square sine wave. It will start becoming some other wave shape, and as such, my receiver can easily become confused, and my more elaborate protocols, like 16 QAM and 64 QAM, will suddenly start having fiercely higher bit error rates. Maybe that helps a little bit. Over to you, Alex, and let's see if we can solve the confusion. N2NNU, a little delay, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Thank you, Dick. There's quite the time that I didn't work with modems anymore. 1997, 98, something like that. Perhaps Glenn will correct me here. But I thought that Viterbi is actually some sort of artificial intelligence program. When most of the modem have a single detector, a single channel of detection of the bits passing by, Viterbi can have up to 32 channels of detection. And it makes a prediction of errors and correction for them, filling in the blank slots in the 16 or 32 detectors with good or bad data, and then it takes a vote on that. I thought that's what Viterbi is. Perhaps Glenn will correct me here. Back to you, Dick.
And I hope that what Alex is pronouncing as Viterbi and what I'm pronouncing as Viterbi, because that's the way I've heard it, I hope we're talking about the same thing. We might be talking about two different things. Let's see if Glenn's got some more information. You got it, Glenn.
Well, actually, you're both right. You know, potato, potato, Viterbi. I call it Viterbi, but Alex is right on the money with that. Basically, what's happening is you have a data stream coming down basically by a hand-shaken software that's really running on both ends. So the transceiver knows what the receiver wants to see, and basically it's sending a data stream down that's encoded, and basically the other side decodes, and there are things like, I think most everybody's familiar with what a codec is. It's a program that basically can take a stream of data and basically explode a whole other group of algorithms and make wonderful things happen. So you could actually send down a small bit of data and create a large amount of functions take place from a small character set. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
By the way, Viterbi has to be randomized in order to work, or you can think of it as scrambling.
Eric, why don't you give us a couple of words on what you believe Viterbi is? I thought it was a protocol for forward error correction, where you could have a certain number of error bits per packet, and Viterbi would allow you to reconstruct the error-free data. That was my understanding of the original Viterbi patent and license, but I could be wrong on that one. Over to you, Eric.
Me too.
And Ed will get to Ed right after Eric. You got it, Eric.
You're basically right. Viterbi has a bunch of extra bits. Actually, we use it in digital television. We use it in satellite transmission. Let's put it this way. It's a method of decoding convolutional codes, okay? It's based on a bit of calculus, which is, as you know, recursive convolution encoding. In order for it to work, it actually has to randomize stuff. So, I'm trying to think of an easy way to explain it, but let's just put it as this, extra bits there. It's a little bit like Reed-Solomon, but not really. There's an encoding algorithm and a decoding algorithm. The you think of it as a binary stream that has convolution encoding. You can actually explain that to folks. It's sort of, if you do a PAM model, it's a way to transmit data and separate it from light gouging noise. Let's put it that way. It is the result of all the other kinds of encoding that we've used in the past, and actually the Turvey can be separated through shift registers, and you can actually display it as a state diagram. It's really far more complicated than that. And Viterbi actually got to use an FFT to encode it and to decode it. And that's one particular form of error correction. But its purpose is to be able to extract data in Gaussian noise, okay? And in many of the transmissions that we use a combination of Viterbi, Reed, Solomon, and outer coring encoding for, you know, specific data. Not necessarily in Ethernet, but because Ethernet is still a DC-based thing. And by the way, going back to the Cat5 cable, just to get this out, there is actually a method in which they do the measuring. It's the ASTM-V 4566 method 3. Whatever that is. If you look that up, there's a specific thing. But let me let it drop. So every 100 meters of cable, okay, at 0.7 of a megahertz, it's 1.8 dB. At 1 megahertz, it's 2 dB. At 4 megahertz, it's 4.1 dB. At 8 megahertz, it's 5.8 dB. At 10, it's 6.5. At 16, it's 8.2. At 20, it's 9.3. At 25, it's 10.4. At 31 and a quarter, it's 11.7. At 62.5, it's 17. At 100, it's 22 dB. And at 155, it's 27 dB. K2RW, K2J.
Wow. What a bunch of memorized data for insertion losses of a cable versus frequencies, what I'm thinking I'm hearing about there. By the way, I was taking Grut old-fashioned Cat5 cable, as well as the Cat5e, and comparing them, but I was transmitting a sine wave of signal at 915 megacycles down that twisted pair. And for the particular application I had, it worked very well. Twisted pair, 915 megacycles. I wasn't going a very long distance. I didn't have a very long distance to go, but I needed a very inexpensive transmission line.
Did you measure propagation delay?
I did not measure group delay, propagation delay, but I think the velocity factor was something in the vicinity of 0.85 or so, if that's what you're asking, Eric, go ahead.
Verification.
Yeah, they say it's 5.7 nanoseconds per meter at 100 megahertz.
Let me think now. 5.7, speed of light is very close to 5.7. That sounds awfully slow. In air, 3 nanoseconds per foot would be, 3.2 nanoseconds per meter. 5.7. Wow. I don't think it was that slow. But you're saying that is the rating. Now back to you, Eric.
Yeah, that's the rating at 100 megahertz. Pick up the other state.
Okay, let's go to Mr. WB2EAV, Ed, and then we're going to go to Alex in that order. Mr. Geller, you have the floor. KQLIW.
It just says that I agreed with you that, to my knowledge, Viterbi is a technique for error correction. And none of the other things that I heard he accused of, that's all. Dick?
I mean, it's 2SCT mobile.
Okay, yeah. Ed, I think your particular rubber duck antenna on that handy talkie you're using might have a loose connection, because I hear it continuously making clicks as you walk and move it. So when you're moving your handy-talkie, it's continuously making clicks. The next person on the list to want to make a comment was Alex, N2NNU. Go right ahead, Alex.
Okay, let me see if I can remember from the times I worked with Viterbi. Most of the codecs and everything else as Glenn is putting it work only on the frequency domain. However, Viterbi works in space-time domain also. There are up to 16 or 32 little decoders in it, and they will decode the same bit slightly different in time and space, meaning they're taking samples of the same bit many times over. And then they're putting the results into a table. When the table is filled, another part of the machine is getting into it and makes a vote which of those entries are best represented. Four or five more of them, this is the sign of the bit. So that's in a nutshell how Viterbi works, but it's much more to it. It's almost in artificial intelligence. However, it is an error correction system, but it's much more than that. When you say error correction, it is just really simplifying it, like saying that I have the CHF, but it's more than that. Back to you, Dick.
And by the way, for anybody who doesn't know what those abbreviations stand for, CHF, that's let me think now, Charlie Hotel Foxtrot stands for congestive heart failure. Turns out in the medical world, my goodness, do they have a bunch of abbreviations. Wow. LVH, for instance, is a left ventricular atrophy, I think it is. Hypoplasia. Left ventricular hypoplasia. They got abbreviations up the kazoo. Now, the next person who signed in was Pete. And Pete is one of those very rare people who lives in that unusual town of Bayville. And from time to time, I tell people that your friends in Bayville have to be helped to recognize the fact that radio is their friend. It is not their enemy. A high significant percentage of the population of Bayville has concluded that radio is their enemy and all radio from that town must be eliminated. And that's an extreme opinion, and we have to slowly bring our friends in Bayville around to a much more rational opinion in the 21st century. Over to you, Pete, WB2SET. And you might be a little bit noisy, so don't make it too long, K2RIW. Okay, looks like Pete's not there right now. The error-correcting codes, the cyclic redundancy codes, the parity checks, those are the very simple techniques we had in the beginning. When you send a chunk of data over a channel, in general, not every one of the bits can be guaranteed to be received with perfect integrity at the other end. And by putting other bits of data in a known location or by a known protocol into the packet, there are ways that the receiver can check whether or not the parity, the cyclic redundancy, the Viterbi, whatever, confirms that the right number of bits of data with the right accuracy was there. And if not, you can either detect the fact that there was an error and tell the sender to please resend packet number 43, I didn't get it correctly. Or in the case of Viterbi, my understanding is that there's enough redundant information in the Viterbi code that allows you to reconstruct the error-free message from the error-prone message as long as the number of bits of error are up to a particular critical limit. Very similar to what's happening with digital television, my understanding is the Viterbi transmitting technique is such that you probably notice with your digital television that if you had the ability to turn a knob which very slowly attenuated the signal-to-noise ratio going into your analog television, you would see a continuous degradation of the signal with snow. Picture would start becoming snowy and ghosty. But until the signal was unwatchable, you would have something on screen. You do the exact same experiment with digital television, and the picture is absolutely perfect, snow-free, up to a particular point, and then all of a sudden, the last fraction of one decibel of change in signal-to-noise ratio, and the picture completely stops moving. It freezes, or becomes a little pixelated, and then freezes. So it's an extremely hard threshold with digital. The good news is that if you get a picture at all, it's snow-free. The bad news is that if you don't meet a certain criteria for signal-to-noise ratio, bit error rate or whatever, for that digital demodulator circuit, it'll give you nothing. It says, I give up, weak signal, forget it, fella. I'm not going to put anything on that screen. It's got a very hard, severe threshold. And that's both good and bad. Well, in the case of a number of us who are getting... Let me drop... A number of us who are getting a simultaneous signal from Channel 2, for instance, what's called Channel 2 is really UHF Channel 33, and there's a UHF Channel 33 being transmitted from Hartford, Connecticut. And I'm sitting on land 300 feet above sea level in Huntington, and my antenna on top of the chimney of my house has not quite line of sight to Hartford, but it's got the reasonable signal level from Hartford. So until I erect a signal, a receiving antenna that has a much higher front-to-side ratio, the simultaneous signal, even though it's a few dB weaker from Hartford, is destroying sometimes my Channel 2 reception. By the same token, Channel 9-1 and 9-2, I have a similar problem. And I'm not alone. So there are various digital channels that quite often you'll discover if you're getting more than one signal in there, you get apparently nothing. Yet you can use your scanner receiver, your R7000, for instance, and you'll see a beautiful amplitude of signal on each one of those channels, and you'll say, what in the world is wrong? Why is my digital, high-definition digital converter of my television, so why is it unhappy with that signal? Well, you use your scanner receiver more accurately, as Joe had done, W2RYY. You listen very carefully to the 325, I think it is roughly kilohertz, so-called pilot tone up from the low end. You listen to it carefully, and you'll realize there are two pilot tones, and they're beating against each other, and you'll see evidence that there's more than one signal there. Other than that, the rest of the signal sounds like noise. You can't tell. But by way of the pilot tone and the two pilot tones beating against each other, you can tell whether or not more than one signal is present. And in many cases, that's the reason why a particular high-definition channel doesn't come through, even though you have sufficient line of sight through Empire State Building to be getting a reasonable signal. And with any questions on all of the above you heard tonight so far, or a brand new question, subject, give us your call letters right now. If there are none, I'm going to go over to Paul, and we'll find out what's going on in space.
It really is a symbol of interference, Dick.
KC2QAQ?
Okay, Eric and Glenn in that order. Go ahead, Eric, and give me a better explanation, Eric, for why there is such an extremely severe threshold with digital, and what happens when there are inter-symbol distortions. So when there's more than one signal, more than one digital channel with slightly different programming, and slightly different timing coming through, why the converter crashes so readily. Over to you, Eric.
And then you.
In that order, we'll get them all. Go ahead, Eric.
All right, to put it quite simply, any form of digital transmission is really through an analog channel. Okay, we forget about that, that the method of getting it into the air is analog. Okay, and you run into certain things, all right? The input, what you're transmitting, what's being modulated, really is a sequence. It's discrete in time and has discrete in value. Okay, you could have a string of bits that says data that turns into numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, you can take that data and clock it, put it into a shift register, and out of each bit of the shift register, you will get the appropriate output. Okay, and then you can put that back together and turn that into a sampled analog picture or whatever it is that you would have. But the realities are is that it'll get disturbed by noise and any kind of neighboring input, say, another station on the same frequency. And what happens is those samples that were accurately created in time, you know, between zero and whatever the clock rate is in the next one, and what's supposed to be coming out of those shift registers get disturbed. And that's what inter-symbol interference is. I mean, it's more complicated than that, but I think that's the simplest way that I can possibly explain it. Any kind of noise, any kind of impulse stuff, or the wrong kind of stuff occupying that same space and time is going to create the problem, and it makes it impossible to decode. So that's what the inter-symbol interference is, and it comes in many different forms. And we call it inter-symbol interference because each one of those bits of data that's being transmitted is a symbol. In the more complicated things like QAM, you could actually have 4 bits represented by a single symbol. And anything that disturbs that is going to make the value of that 4 bits wrong. Keep to RW, KA2Z.
Come into RY1.
And Joe, the third person in the list. I've got a question for you here, though, Eric, and that is, you may not know the exact number, but you might have a gut feel. If I have true co-channel interference, I've got two separate channels of information coming from different broadcast centers coming into my receiving antenna, and they're on the exact same frequency per se, both on UHF channel 33 in my case, when I want to watch what's called channel 2. How much weaker must the second one be so that I have reasonable probability of getting proper reception? I'm going to guess it's in the vicinity of 20 dB, that the undesired signal must be approximately 20 decibels weaker than the desired signal before I get significant loss of data. That's question number one. And question number two, is there a built-in error detecting system? In other words, of the quasi-packets of information that are being sent by advanced television, the ATS system, is there a way that the digital converter knows that it has erroneous data? Is there the equivalent of a cyclic redundancy code built into the data? So DB first and error detecting code second. Over to you, Eric. K2EJ, K2RIW in the tech net.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, you know, when they invented 8BSB, they thought a lot about that. As far as the ATSC is concerned, the threshold is 27 dB as far as they're concerned. We've had this argument before. We're not going to go through it. You'll find that there are a lot of receivers out there that have better sensitivity, but as far as the ATSC and the FCC are concerned, that's the magic number. As far as being able to identify, it's all about separating your clock from the data, because that's God in terms of being able to figure out where the time slots are that data comes out. If you were able to, say, take a variable delay line, and you just fortunately the two TV stations operating on the same channel, although they're both maybe driven by 10 megahertz that's being derived from GPS, so they would in fact be phase locked with each other, there's the issue of propagation delay. If you could actually tweak the clock in the receiver and lock up to, say, one pilot or the other pilot, you would actually be able to successfully decode one station or the other. I mean, that's like pulling a rabbit out of a hat, but that concept exists. There are actually three levels on the RF side of error correction. There is the trellis, which actually is creating this symbol. It actually takes, if you take, say, 10 megabits of data and you put it into the trellis, the transmitted rate, because of all the extra bits that are going on, will be 20 megabits. So that's just a simple example. Really, the reality is that we get 19 megabits, multiply that by 2, that's the actual transmission rate. There is the Viterbi, which actually helps to recover the signal from any kind of Gaussian noise or any other kinds of disturbances that are short in duration. If it's too long in duration, it gets lost because there's too much information that's missing. And then there's another thing called inner and outer correction, which is a form of Reed Solomon, but it does it on a field basis. So every 16 milliseconds, it's actually grabbing data to use for the next 16 milliseconds. So if it successfully gets the data in the first 16 milliseconds and the data is missing in the next 16 milliseconds, it will actually figure out what the missing data is and put it in. K2RW, KE2J.
My goodness. We went from a nice, simple system of analog television and we went to this very complicated digital ATSC, Advanced Television Selection Committee system. That's a little bit of a joke on my part. As you can tell, there's a lot to that signal these days. The good news is you can transmit channel 7-1, 2, 3. The 1/6 megacycle wide frequency allocation now can have three continuous streams of data along with various chunks of audio and whatever. I think one of the channels I watch, I believe it's 31, has got 11 subcarriers to it. Some of them are only audio, but there are 11 subchannels to it. All right, the next person who signed in the group was Glenn, KC2Q. It's going to be Glenn, Alex, and Joe in that order. KC2QIQ, you had a comment or question. Go right ahead, Glenn.
Sure, I just wanted to talk about the Viterbi algorithm just a little bit more because, one of the things that maybe I wasn't explaining it clearly, but I was trying to gather my thoughts and put it in the most simplest term I could think of. And what I would think of when I sort of think of a Viterbi algorithm is, let's say if you wanted to light two light bulbs, a green light bulb and a red light bulb, and each one you wanted to light for just 30 seconds. So if you wrote a program on one end that would turn the red light bulb on for 30 seconds or the green one, and you'd have to give it some kind of a digital sequence that it needed to see, an exact sequence. One to turn on the red one, one to turn on the green one, it would go on for 30 seconds and then shut off. Now, if you go to send a data signal down, you could send this data phrase, basically to this program, and we can call that the Viterbi phrase, let's say. And that Viterbi phrase, if it's not exact, it won't execute that function. Now, the funny thing about Viterbi phrases are you can have multiple of them and send them many, many times. But unless the program sees the key exactly the way it's supposed to be, it won't do that function. And, of course, it doesn't have to be light bulbs. They can be tremendous programs running on the other side. And once it sees that phrase, it can do any one of those functions. And the artistry in that is the more and more elaborate they become, it's exponential, the amount of functions that you can create, and then run them in back of other programs and do multiple things. But unless it sees that phrase exactly the way it's supposed to be, you can have all kinds of noise on the system and everything else, but it will not do that function. So that's really my simplest way of explaining what the Viterbi algorithm is. Hopefully I didn't add more confusion. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
You're really explaining what the Markov algorithm is, which is the basic component of Viterbi. It's more complicated than that, but that's what Markov is.
Is that Markov algorithm orthogonal? In other words, can I have three or four individual pieces of information that are orthogonal to each other, like they're kind of a gold code, so to speak? Eric, go ahead.
Well, Markov is really basically a set of rules. What you can do is you can think of it as when you write something binary, you write to their unary counterparts.
I've obviously got to study this some more. The next person who would have signed was Alex, N2NNU. You've got your window in time. Go right ahead, Alex.
Hey, guys. I'm going to make that my last. I have some chores to do here, too. What a can of worms I opened with that horse with Turby. Will it be the first one on Yonkers Raceway? Well, you never know. Talking about the DTV, Nick, I have this old VR7000 that I used to listen to TV stations when they were analog. Now the VR7000 is completely silent. Intentionally byproduct of the transition to digital TV. Question. Is that a receiver, an audio receiver just for the digital TV? I'm kind of missing that background noise here in my little shack. Back to you, Rick.
I vaguely remember that Eric did tell us that we can either buy a module to be added to our scanner receiver, like an ICR7000, or maybe there's a whole piece of hardware, but I'll bet you somebody is building a chipset which allow us to listen to just the audio of a over-the-air broadcast ATSC television channel, a digital television channel. KE2EJ, where do I go? How many dollars? Can I buy a module that I plug into my R7000? You got it, Eric. K2LIW.
I don't want a 7000. I want a self-standing unit.
I understand. He's going to give us all of the above. Go ahead, Eric.
No, I never said that you could add a module to an I-7000. It's a lot of problems with that. To extract the sound is the same as extracting the picture. We forget that digital transmission is not picture and sound. It's simply a string of data. If you had a shift register
that was 1024 bits long. I could say, actually, I'll make it a little more complicated. I would put an address. I would first transmit an address. Let's say I transmit an address, 01. So the first two bits are 01, and I know from rules that those first two bits are an address. And wherever that 01 is, I'm going to transmit another 10 bytes of data, and that 10 bytes of data is going to be a piece of picture. And then I'm going to have another address like 02. And the next 10 bytes of data, because of a rule that I've set up, is going to be 10 bytes of audio. So really, the transmission system just sends data. How you actually get video and audio and guide information and stereo and all this stuff is really sort of like what's coming out of the RF transmitter, the same thing that happens when you look at a DVD. A DVD actually uses the same format of MPEG. MPEG says that I have something which is an address header, or a PID, or a program ID address bit. And that program ID address bit has a number which is assigned to, there's actually a set of rules. A particular number is video. Another particular number is audio. Another particular number is data that follows it of a specific length. And in digital television, the packets are 188 bytes apiece. So, to extract audio from that stream, you need a very long shift register, and you need to be able to know what the address of that audio data is and extract it. Since there is so much data going on there, we actually have stuff called a VCT, a virtual channel table. And from that virtual channel table, it will say what the PIDs are for, say, channel 4-1's video and channel 4-1's audio, which might be a 3.5 hex, and the audio might be, actually, the video would be 3.1 hex, and the first channel of audio would be 3.5 hex. And if there's a second channel of audio, there would be 3.6 hex, etc. So, but there is radios coming out with the stuff that you need to first grab the stream, let me make a drop, and then actually extract from the virtual channel table where the audio is. So, a module that goes on your radio, I never said that, and I don't think that will ever happen, because the whole business of extracting data from the stream, after you heterodyne it and turn it upside down and do a few other things, makes it rather difficult. If you look at a digital tuner, the actual data separator is in the tuner. It's really funny. Then you have equalizers and a whole bunch of other stuff. And as you know, 8VSB doesn't like to have moving antennas at this point. So that's why they came out with something called EVSB, or Advanced VSB, which is now being made available to the broadcast to transmit. And receivers are being manufactured. And it uses much lower bit rate, but it's compatible with the current 8VSB. It's actually 4VSB and 2VSB. So it runs much slower, and it can handle more errors of multipath and things of that nature. You will eventually see receivers that will be able to pick up TV sound. You will have to actually dial into it as to what you want to listen to based on what's around. And also the HD receivers that you might have in your car actually have the front ends of that stuff. K2RIW, K2JO.
Wow. I'm going to anticipate Alex's next question. Yes, Alex could, in theory, go out and buy an extremely tiny digital television receiver. He only wants the audio. He could put some duct tape across the screen, because he doesn't want to watch the screen. He just want to hear the audio. In theory, he could do that. How soon do you think it will be, and how many dollars will it cost for somebody to build what used to be a pocket transistor radio that will handle all that complicated stuff you just told us, and just give me the selectable audio for that channel. How soon will it be when I can buy one of those? What's your guess as to how much it'll cost? Over to you, Alec. I mean, Eric. KE2EJ, KQLIW. Eric, are you still there? Somebody gave us a very strong carrier with no audio. KE2EJ, are you there? KQLIW.
That was him talking. He had virtually no, I could hear his audio. It was virtually non-existent.
Okay, it looks like you got an intermittent mic there, Eric. Twist that mic cord and try again, because we didn't get one bit of audio.
Hello, you hear me?
Myself.
You're coming through loud and clear. Now you've got real audio. The previous transmission, not one bit of audio came through for the average reader. Listener, over to you, Eric.
All right, hello. I don't think that I'm shaking everything. Nothing's loose. Maybe somebody was stepping on me. Okay. What I said was you now can go to Radio Shack, so I think it's $125, $130. You can get this little box that's got an antenna on it. It also has a little LCD screen on it, like a Sony Walkman, a little Watchman rather. It's a little portable DTV receiver. It's made in Korea. I forget the name of the manufacturer. The only bad thing about it is the thing draws a lot of juice, so the battery doesn't last all that long. They're still making VLSIs that CMOS, but it still draws a hunk of DC power, so that's going to be a while before that even comes down a bit. But even if you go and buy yourself an HD radio, which has the same sort of stuff in it, the HD radio has the ability to take and decode the digital signal and turn it into a stream, which by the way, the HD radio also works on the same principle. That stream has kids in it. The kids tell you what channel you're listening to. Your satellite radio is the same thing. It does that too. And of course, as the Koreans and the Chinese manufacture more and more, the prices will come down even further. K2RIW, K2J.
Very fine, Eric. I was listening on the input before, and if it was a phony signal, it had the exact same amplitude as your signal from the same direction of arrival, and there wasn't one bit of audio. There was audio there, but it was 50 dB down, so there was a slight intermittent there. Alrighty, there's one brand for $125, roughly, of I think you said a Korean-made radio, sold by Radio Shack, that'll give me high-definition television, audio only as a portable device, and if it draws... I think you said it draws a lot of current and eats up its battery right away. Maybe it runs on pen light cells, and I could make an adapter to make it run off D cells, and that will make it last a long time. So is there only one brand and one model number available for $125 roughly at this time? Eric, go ahead.
Okay, guys, good night. Have fun. And to an annual.
All right, first of all, I didn't say Radio Shack. I said Walmart. That's one thing. Hello, am I there? Yeah, I'm here. It is a television receiver. It's not a radio. And what I did say is that HD radio that you can get for your car, you get for your home, basically has the same sort of stuff that works in the same method, but it doesn't receive 8 BSC. It receives IBOP, which is a different transmission standard, but the actual end result after you decode, after you turn the RF back into data, is a stream that has kids. Same thing with your satellite radio. So it's just the HD radio method of modulating or sending the data over the air is different than 8BSB. So, but the end result is the same thing. And that little portable TV, like a Watchman, got an LCD screen in it. It's just like your digital receiver at home. Same deal. It's just it draws a lot of juice. The batteries don't last that long.
Okay, so that's a small HD TV, portable, Walmart, roughly $125, and it's a battery eater. Nobody makes an audio-only equivalent, to your knowledge, at this time. Eric, go ahead.
quite frankly, I don't think anybody ever will.
Hold on now. There's a demand for that. There are a significant number of people out there who walk around in with a shopping cart during the day. They don't care about the picture. They want to hear the audio of their favorite soap opera or their favorite quiz program or whatever. There is a demand out there for people who only want the audio, and they're busy doing other things, and they don't want to watch the video. So I know there's a demand for it. You don't think anyone's going to fulfill that demand, is what I think you're saying, Eric, go ahead.
Well, I dare you to take your digital television receiver and walk around with it and have it stay locked.
Hold on now. Aren't there television, high-def television-like systems I can install into my automobile? And if it has an equalizer network that operates fast enough, can I get a mediocre probability of reception? I'm going to get some dropouts. But as I drive down the highway, you're telling me there is nothing that can give me digital television in a moving vehicle at this time. Is that what you're saying, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, well, yeah, the equalizer is getting better, but it ain't good enough for moving. That's why they came up with EVSB, or enhanced VSB, which is now just coming into play. That would mean that the TV station, in order to have mobile reception, will have to transmit EVSB, which is compatible with 8VSB, except that you won't have six channels or two channels or three channels, and also the bit rate of the image will be very poor. But that would be good enough for audio. Maybe in about 5 years or so, you'll begin to see it hit the market.
To your knowledge at this time, how many of the high-def current television stations in the New York City area have EVSB transmit capability and are using it? Over to you, Eric.
No, we're all capable of it. It's just a matter of changing the exciter. But so far in the United States, I think there's two, because those were the experimental stations. But the FCC has yet to finish putting its signature on it, which I think is supposed to happen pretty soon. And the reason for going with the EVSB is that the broadcasters want it to be included in the cell phones.
Wow. Okay, those two experimental stations that are currently using it, do you happen to know where they're located, Eric?
Yeah, I think one was in Washington, one was in Seattle, and I don't think they're operating anymore.
So is it just a special temporary authority? It was just an experiment, and depending on the success of the experiment, the FCC will give an approval, and then it sounds like a fairly long road before we have portable digital audio or video reception capability. I'm slowly getting the impression, Eric, that we have lost a number of previous capabilities. I, for one, used to be able to listen to the audio channel of a television set on my scanner receiver. Obviously, I can't do that anymore. So in this ATSC switchover, we've lost some of our previous capability, and I'm hearing the sounds of it's going to take multiple years to get some of these functions back. Now back to you, Eric.
I would say don't hold your breath. The FCC is currently looking to take away more broadcaster space and give it to broadband people. They're thinking, I was reading just yesterday, that they figure that they're going to get $62 billion by selling off the space that the broadcasters have, and kind of forcing the over-the-air stuff to go away is what their intent is. And there's a lot of people that are very, very unhappy about that whole concept, and the FCC is supposed to deliver their thinking and their reasoning in February. So, because they feel that broadband airspace there's just not enough of it for the broadband people out there. And besides, they're saying that the broadcasters never paid for their spectrum. So, go figure, Dick.
GSC.
GSC recognized, and you've got one person ahead of you. Let me write down GSE. The 700 megacycle region, I think, has recently been given over and sold to Verizon and somebody else, Netscape, I guess it was. Now, but two of the cell phone companies have bought the 700 meg region, to my knowledge. Correct me on this one, Eric. When will that become operational? And are you talking about even more chopping into those frequencies, like going down to 600 meg? Is that what you're talking about as a current FCC proposal? Over to you, Eric.
Yes, I am. And even lower than 600 megahertz. Was it 4 years ago, Qualcomm bought all the Channel 55s in the country. All of them. And they started doing their, what the heck is the name of it? Now, I can't think of the trade name, but that's what they use for their cell phone stuff. It'll come to me, of course, when I'm not thinking about it, but that's already in place and operating. You look at where Channel 55 is, and you'll see a whole bunch of digital carriers that don't look like anything that you've seen before. I can't think of the name of it, the trade name. It'll come to me. But, yeah, that's all in place. And all the auction space, which, by the way, some of the auction space they couldn't sell because people couldn't afford to pay for it, or the company didn't have the money for it. But they want to take more away and divvy it up and give it to the broadband folks. So, and then, of course, that takes us to the concept of net neutrality and things like that, which, you know, becomes very political. But, the broadcasters, over-the-air broadcasting, seems to be on its way out the door.
Now, the 700 meg region sounds to me like it was given and sold to, I think, Nextel and Verizon, and that's going to be cell phones. Wasn't some of that region supposed to be given to first responders? Are the first responders being given some of the spectrum? And I think there's a three-letter abbreviation for this new spectrum region. And is there another three-letter abbreviation given to the 600 meg region? Will first responders get any of that? Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, no, there's a chunk of it that's reserved for the first responders and public safety and that kind of stuff. And there's a chunk of it that was above that was auctioned off to Verizon and a few others. And Qualcomm, and damn, I just can't think of the name. If I can think of the service, it's what Verizon and a few other folks are using for live TV on the telephone.
Okay, we've got Joe and Mr. GSE in that order. Joe, to meet you on YY, go right ahead with your questions or comments.
Okay, I'm not sure what the name is. Is it Media Flow or something like that? I think it was what Eric maybe was talking about. I've heard it once or twice on someplace else. But anyway, my question was about the DTV. I've noticed that on some channels the carriers are not the same from one station to another. They're actually shifted by as simple as 110 hertz, sometimes as much as almost 300 hertz, sometimes between different stations that they can reach. Like taking, for example, channel 33, RF33 from New York and RF33 from Hartford, those two stations are about 110 hertz apart. Why is that? Would everybody be supposed to be on the same operating frequency within like 10 hertz or so?
Yeah, my question along those lines also, Eric, is that are they intentionally offset? I can't believe there's a frequency error here. Are they intentionally offset very similar to the plus or minus 10 KC we used to have on analog television as a signal identifier? Over to you, Eric.
Now, if you remember back, I think in the spring we were talking about that, and that was when you had what they called N plus 1, when the analogs and the digitals were operating together. As far as I know, and I don't think that I'm wrong about it, there is no longer any offset because there's no point. You used to be able to know where an offending station came from in the analog world by actually taking the difference between the two. Some were plus 25 kilohertz, some were down 25 kilohertz. You could actually take the audio beat note and figure out where your offending signal, your co-channel was originating from. With the ABS-B step, that game doesn't work.
Okay, Joe, how recently did you measure that frequency error? Because now that the analog and digital is not being sent simultaneously, Eric sounds like he believes there should be no frequency errors anymore. How recently was that last 120 hertz of offset measured by you, Joe? From K2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet?
Last week, an RF channel channel 33. I was able to see 110 hertz, about 110 hertz shift between WFSB in Hartford and New York City, FSB being higher. On channel 13, I saw